The Blast from Our Past Network.
Hey guys, this is Charles Edwin Powell. I just want to say, get off my back, man, and go watch Podcasting After Dark. Do it now. Get off my back.
Welcome to our exclusive interview series for Podcasting After Dark with your hosts, Corey Stevenson and Zach Schaefer. Tonight's interview is with the star of Screamers and Stream, actor Charles Edwin Powell.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to another awesome episode of Interviews After Dark. The irony is, if you're watching the video, we always record our interviews after dark during the daytime, but that's neither here nor there. We have this episode, we have Charles Edwin Powell. We've been wanting to talk to him for so freaking long, but he's a busy man and he's hard to lock down, and I'm happy about that. I'm happy that you're working so much, buddy. But Charles, how's it going, my man?
Guys, thank you very much for having me on. I appreciate your time. Absolutely. Oh. No, it's going well, man. I can't complain. I mean, I could, but who's listening, right?
Exactly. And of course, Zach is with me as always on these interviews.
I'm here too, but it feels like we've known Charles for quite some time now because, you know, we all follow each other on Instagram, and in the day of social media, you feel like your relationship with somebody, you know, for better or worse, is stronger because you get to see like insights to their life. So, you know, we see what's going on with Charles. He sees what's going on with us. It's like, oh, I want to talk to you about your son, or I want to talk to Corey telling me about your trip to Oregon, you know. Anyways, it's wild, and I'm so glad we could make this happen. And Charles, you've been that guest that we've wanted to get on for a really long time. Corey was like, we got to get Charles Edwin Powell on. Can we make it happen? I'm like, it's going to happen. It's just, you know, three years down the road.
I mean, you know, Charles, that I'm a big fan. We both are, but I'm a huge fan of Screamers. And, you know, if I went back in time and told 1995 me that I'd be talking to you, I wouldn't believe it.
Well,
but here we are.
1995, Charlie was freezing his butt off during Screamers right about now. So it's nice to get out of that snow.
I'm sure you were, but let's dive into Screamers. I know that came a little bit later after Exorcist 3, but you know, while we're talking about Screamers right now, you play Neb Soldier Ross. Your shtick was get off my back, and that was kind of like a red herring to make people think that maybe you were, you know, one of the cyborgs, one of the killer robots in the movie. Spoiler alert. You weren't.
In case someone hasn't seen it 30 years later, you know, in case you haven't seen it.
Yeah, exactly. We reviewed it, I think, in season two of our show. Yeah. We had a blast reviewing it and everything. But what was that experience like?
Overall, I just a big broad stroke. I had a fantastic time. The we shot that. Oh boy, we shot that in Canada. We shot that in Montreal, or outside of Montreal, or maybe it was Quebec. I'm not sure. And then we shot a lot of the interiors in that stadium that the Montreal Expos used to play in. I don't remember the name of it, but if you actually I don't know if it's still around, but if you look at it, it looks like something that was straight out of Star Trek. It does not look like an event place for a baseball team. You know, it looks like a starship of some kind. So we were up in the top deck of that thing, shooting all the blood and the guts and the screamers and the, you know, the special effects and stuff. It was overall, and Peter Weller was a fantastic, fantastic guy to work with. Jennifer, Andy, and Roy, and most of my stuff was with those three guys.
Yeah.
And had a great time. Yeah, I had a great time.
And was that something you auditioned for and just got the role?
Yeah. Yeah. I auditioned for it just like everybody. Well, I don't think Peter did, but we all auditioned for it as far as I know. And then, it was my understanding that Schwarzenegger had optioned that script, leading into us, shooting it. But I think he was going to shoot it somewhere in the desert or something. And I guess that had fallen apart. Again, I don't know. We're going back quite a while. But I remember somebody saying something about Schwarzenegger optioning the script, and that kind of fell through. So then they went this direction and decided to shoot it up in the frozen tundra with wardrobe that looked great, but just didn't perform at all.
There
was a lot of numb fingers and toes by the end of that shoot, you know?
Oh my gosh.
Oh wow. Now, did you read the story by Philip K. Dick before filming?
The short story, the short story of I can't remember the name of it right offhand, but yeah, it was based on a short story. What the hell was it called? It was
I'm blanking on it apologize.
I know it if I heard it, but no, it was but at the time we had all that literature in front of us, so we were able to read it.
Okay. And was the
second variety?
That's right, second variety. Yep, I was just about to look it up. And the character of Ross chewing on like his Did you bring that to the table?
Yeah, the director Christian was very open to us kind of doing whatever we wanted to do with our particular characters within the confines of what was given to us. So with the wardrobe stuff, because I don't I have kind of a southern accent, being from Texas. I decided to sort of brand Ross with a little bit of that southern flair to it, and was able to do that. And oddly enough, chewing on that piece of leather was sort of my way of showing the anxiety and the angst that he has, the shell shockness of what he's seen and gone through. And it gave him something to do when there was nothing to do. Basically, you know, it's kind of, we call it busy work, but it worked out really well until it started to discolor my teeth. But I think even that, it worked out great. It you know, continuity is like, you got to stop chewing on that thing. I can stop your mouth. Like, all right, whatever.
This is way before teeth bleaching too. So, well, there was bleaching back then. It would just kill your gums.
This was all practical too. There was very little visual effects. It was all, I mean, this is back when they were still drawing on mats. You know, there were matte paintings for the scenery and stuff. So, and I think that was probably at the end of that type of special effects as we're moving into the visual effects side of it. And, you know, practical effects kind of went out. Now they're kind of coming back. So,
well, that's one of the charms to Screamers, I think, is the fact that you're not dealing with, and this is coming at a time when visual effects were very awkward with their presentation. You know, when it came to video effects or, you know, any sort of CGI, and you're looking at things going, ooh, that is clearly not real. So Screamers has so much charm. I think we might even have said this in the episode, that it's held up really well over the years, and dare I say has improved with time, I think, because at the time the audience, I have this love-hate relationship with the mid-90s, because I feel like a lot of great things came out of it, but at the same time too, I'm like, I don't think the things were appreciated as they should have been. Right. And I think Screamers is a perfect example of that. I remember when it came out, I remember seeing it in the theater, and now, you know, 20, 30 years later, we're appreciating it to a different level.
Right. Yeah. No, I heard someone went to go see it in the theater. Now I know who it was.
Yeah. I was the one guy.
It died a slow, painful death, a very quick, painful death, depending on how you look at it. But with the invent of like the sort of the subcultures cult viewing of that science fiction world and the fans out there, it kind of had a rebirth, if you will, back in there. And you do have to look at it a little bit with the tongue in the cheek, especially with the,
of course,
5K TVs nowadays. Yeah. You know, it's like going back to watch The Exorcist. You know, some of that's, I mean, even though it still holds up, but a lot of those effects and stuff, you kind of go, oh yeah, you know.
I mean, I had a moment like that.
Maybe if I squint a little bit, it looks good, you know.
I did have a moment with my son when he was younger, watching Star Wars for the first time on our big giant TV in pristine, you know, quality, and the paint was flaking off one of the helmets, and he's like, "That's so cheap looking." I go, "Bud,
it's all cheap. It's funny too, because nowadays these cosplayers, they're making better costumes than than they actually made in the movies and stuff.
Yeah.
But so are you seeing a nice little resurgence of Screamers?
I do from the fan base. When I was in New Jersey for the HorrorCon in Edison, what was that, like a month ago or so? I was shocked at how many people walked in and went, "Yeah, I remember you from Screamers," because I really thought that was going to be like the left out, you know, I'm going to take a Sharpie to it and put it, you know, cross it out afterwards. But I was surprised at how many people walked in that door and talked about Ross and talked about Screamers. And it was nice, you know, it's because sometimes you forget how much time goes by and you learn to appreciate the fan base even more so. I was blown away at the horror community out in New Jersey, and it was something that was new to me. And even though I'm a fan of horror films, that was my introduction to the gory horror part of horror. Right. And I didn't really know much about that. So when they walked in, you could just feel the love from these people, and it was a beautiful thing.
That's awesome.
Yeah, there's a cool thing about those conventions. I was speaking with someone about this in regards to Los Angeles. We're here in L.A. Well, I'm in L.A. Corey's up in Oregon. But the difference between a con here in L.A. versus one, let's say, in New Jersey or, you know, somewhere in the Midwest, Idaho or whatever. And there's that audience doesn't get to see, you know, actors, directors, writers, et cetera, on a regular basis like we would here in Los Angeles. So it's really an event, you know, it is the thing they look forward to all year long. Yeah. So when you are getting to meet some of these people, these fans, you know, it's a really big deal. And I love that you appreciate that too, because, you know, it's like they've saved up their hard earned money to come support you, and the love is all mutual.
Right. No, that support is not lost on me whatsoever. And even with the Fuzz guys, I know how much that they embrace it, and they try to give back as much as they can. And when it came to that convention, I was very fortunate to be invited, and I hope to do others, because that's really the only way you get to interact with people that are fans of the, like, I don't know any other genre except for maybe Japanese anime that has a following that follows the conventions. You know what I mean? I've never seen anything like it before, and I couldn't get enough of it. You know, it was fantastic. Well,
and now you're a bona fide, you know, horror star with Scream.
Yeah.
That came out last year, 2024. Yeah. And you know, you're the lead in that. You're the dad in that. And that movie's a lot of fun. I just watched it two nights ago and had a blast with it. It's by the producers of Terrifier 2 and 3. And it definitely has that gooiness, but it's a fun movie, and I don't want to spoil anything because it's still so new.
Well, I haven't seen it yet, so don't spoil it for me.
Well, here's what happens to your character. No, I'm just kidding. But I was at a horror convention last year as well in Baltimore, and I saw the Scream masks were there. People were selling them, and people seem to be really, you know, hyping on it and everything like that. So what's it like to now be a bona fide horror icon?
I tell you, Mike took a big gamble bringing me in, because you look at the list of, I don't know if you follow horror as much as a lot of these guys do, but they live it and breathe it and eat it, you know. Yeah. And you look at that, the list of cast of people, and I kind of go, what am I doing here? What am I?
You're crushing it. That's what you're doing there.
The hell am I? You know, Mike still gives me a hard time about it. And it's sort of a running joke at this point. But no, he took a big chance on me, and I am forever grateful for that. And again, that is not lost on me too. And that was actually the first film that I did when I got back into the on camera part of the industry. I'd been out for about 13 years. I have twins, and once our kids were born, I just decided to play Mr. Mom for a while and
awesome.
Be like a dad, and did some voice work, and the voice work was taken off. So I was able to work from home and take care of the kids. And after about 13 years, I got back in the industry, and then COVID hit. And then I said, well, okay, what am I going to do now? But then there was this term running around that I'd never heard of. And when I opened it up, I said, what the hell is a self-tape? Like, what is that supposed to mean? Yeah. What is that?
Yeah.
So I made some phone calls and had some people walking me through the process, because that didn't really exist when I was still working, right?
No.
So I go back and I look at some of my self-tapes now, and I think all I need is a newspaper, and it looks like a ransom note. Because, I mean, I swear to you, the lighting was horrible. I looked like I was straight out of a horror film, and I'm just right. Like, you know, just send the money here and I'll be fine. You know, but it was a learning experience, and thank goodness we've all moved forward since that time. But overall with Stream, yeah, just working with Jeffrey. I got to work with Jeffrey quite a bit, Jeffrey Combs, and I absolutely adore that man. He's bigger than life when he works, and it you just can't help but being sucked into that energy, you know. And he brings it. And Danielle was wonderful, and the kids, Wes and Sydney. So I overall had a fantastic time.
Yeah, no, it's a great cast, and you know, you are the central point to the whole film, and sort of everything, you know, how your character's dealing with stuff, and you know, just kind of trying to survive. But you know, it is an effects heavy film, although you kind of didn't have to go through as much. But how did having to work around the effects and everything, was that hard at all, or did it not really affect you?
No, pun intended. I think for me, approaching the character, Mike and I had a very long conversation before we started shooting, and he said it's important that we establish this family and the people, and it's probably going to take longer than most horror movies are going to by establishing this family at the beginning, because they don't jump right into the madness of it until about 30 to 45 minutes into the script. So we're going to establish who you are. Being a dad myself, it wasn't tough because, you know, I've said this before, I've had these same conversations with my kids that I was having in the film. So that wasn't a big stretch. The stretch for me was I've never dealt with that kind of violence on screen before. So Mike was very open to my angst and my anxiety about it, because you don't really know like how to react, and you want to be, and at least I try to be as organic as possible when I work, and as opposed to not over rehearsing it too much kind of thing.
Yeah.
And Mike was wonderful about saying, well, you know, why don't you do what you want to do? And then I'll do what, you know, I want to see you do. And then we'll feel it out. We'll try a few things. And then he said, I'll figure it out in the editing room, you know, because we don't know how heavy we want to go here or how light we want to go here. And I really appreciated that, you know, those were some long days, and you know, the death, yeah, I don't want to give it away, but I'm sure people have seen it by now. But
we don't want to spoil too much.
No. But there's a couple of scenes in there that were pretty heavy, and Mike and I were like, you know, just let's just go for it and see what happens, and then we'll do a bunch of different takes. And then he goes, I'll figure it out in the editing room, and I really appreciated that from him, because it does take some pressure off of you when you're not used to dealing with that type of violence on screen.
Yeah, it's still a slasher, and it's like, you know, a modern, you know, neo-noir slasher, so it's pretty gory.
Yeah.
Although not as gory as Terrifier, I'd say. But I do appreciate that the movie does spend like a solid like 20 to 30 minutes at the beginning sort of building you and Daniel Harris's relationship and your family up and everything. And you know, when I first saw it, I was like, oh, a 2-hour runtime, that's pretty long for a slasher, you know, for a horror movie. But I was like, cool. And then, first off, didn't even like notice, you know, the 2-hour runtime. I was just like engrossed in it. And then after the movie was over, I was like, oh, you know what? I appreciate that they took the time to actually build up your all's family dynamic and everything. And also, too, like so many times kids can be annoying in a movie and stuff. Neither of the kids, like in like your quote unquote, you know, kids in the movie, neither of them were annoying. And I love the relationship that you had with them and everything. And it felt natural. And like you said, probably because you know, you are a parent and everything, but it was nice that the movie let your all's relationship breathe, you
right.
know?
No, it was important to Mike too, and you know, he took a big risk. He knew he was taking a big risk by letting that story kind of play itself out, as opposed to like jumping, like with the Terrifier series, it does have elements of that. And I have to say, having Damien on set with us doing the practical effects, the director for Terrifier, he was also doing our practical effects. You just kind of like let him do his thing, you know? And Mike's made the comment before, he goes, it wasn't necessarily scripted that way. But when you have somebody like Damien around, and he's so good at what he does, you just kind of say, okay, here you go. And how can we help you, you know, make this happen? You know?
Yeah.
It's interesting too. I had a little bit of a flashback, because I was interviewing over on my other show, $2 Late Fee. I was interviewing Mark Holton from Teen Wolf. And we were doing a whole Teen Wolf 2 retrospective a couple years back. And he said, we were talking about, oh, do you have any upcoming projects? And he goes, yeah, I'm heading to shoot one of those really gory, like slasher movies, you know, for the guys that did those Terrifier movies. I'm really excited about it. I'm working with a bunch of great people. And so here we are, flash forward so many years later, and Stream comes out. It's like, oh, it's all full circle now.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, no, Mark was wonderful. I never got a chance to work with him, but I did get a chance to cross paths with him before he wrapped.
It's a wild, like, the film itself, there was a movie that came out many, many years ago called Colobos that was very Italian horror inspired, but it was about people trapped in a home, and this was around the time Real World came out, so everything was being shot on video and like a reality series, basically. And when the original pitch or the idea came, when Stream was coming out, I thought of that movie because I really like Colobos. I think it's an underrated film. But I love the concept, and it hasn't really been done that often.
Yeah. You would think it would have been done more, but it hasn't. And then, you know, you couple that concept with some great masks, like any good slasher movie, you have to have like the killers in a really cool mask. And I don't know who designed the one for Stream, but the first second I saw it, I was like, you know, winner, like right there. You got me hooked just because of that visual aesthetic of it.
Yeah, I was quite surprised at seeing how many people were walking around in the costumes.
You're saying that
in Jersey, you know, that was just mind boggling.
Yeah, it's definitely become like a pretty big hit within the horror community. Yeah. So I'm super happy to see that. But let's roll back to like one of your earliest roles in a horror film, in a very not sort of divisive horror film these days, I guess, but Exorcist 3, what was your role in that?
Okay, let's back that up a little
and how did that happen?
Yeah. Well, I had only been in Los Angeles maybe 5-6 months at that time, maybe.
From Texas?
From Texas, yeah.
What part of Texas, by the way?
Just outside of Houston, Missouri City, which is near Sugar Land, sort of that area down there.
Yeah.
About 45 minutes from Galveston. It's not too far from the...
Nice, that's where I have family that lives in Galveston, so...
Yeah. And I got this audition for it and went my agent. And so I went to the casting office, and when I got over there, she handed me a piece of paper and said, can you read this for me? I read it, and they said, okay, follow me. We walked across the street to, I want to say it was Sunset Gower, maybe the old Desilu Studios. And walked into the studio, and they rang the bell. They started shooting. As I looked up, and I see George C. Scott with a gun in his hand, and I looked at the AD walking me across the street, and I went. She goes, "I know. She just did one of these things." I said, "No shit," you know. And so I'm like, because I don't know what I'm doing. They didn't tell me what I was doing. They just walked me over there, and then they walked me into the green room after they cut. And then they said, just go over this paragraph. Somebody will come in. And so this gentleman came in and I read it. He said, okay, good. Read it again. Just read it a little slower. He said, okay, thank you. He went back out. The AD said, thank you. We walked out. We walked back across the street, and that was the end of it. Well,
wow.
As it turns out, I asked them, I said, what exactly is this for? And they said, well, it's a reshoot for The Exorcist 3. And I said, okay. What does that mean? She goes, well, she goes, from my understanding, there was no exorcism in The Exorcist 3. So they're funding a reshoot that's about 4 weeks long. So they had to bring back Jason Miller, Nicole Williamson, George C. Scott, and maybe some other people. I don't know. But by the time I got in there, Jason Miller was only going to be there about 2 more days. Nicole Williamson was there for the next 3 weeks. And George C. Scott, I think, was wrapping the day that I had walked in. So they ended up hiring me. And as it was explained to me, Jason Miller is going to wrap out. They're going to shoot a lot of his close-up dialogue in the cell with Nicole Williamson. But they need 3.5 more weeks of shooting with Jason. He's not going to be here. That's where you come in. So what they did was I went through all this prosthetic makeup and made the outside of my face look like Jason, which you guys have probably seen the photos by now.
Yeah.
And the only reason I'm even talking about this now is because years ago, some stuff came out about the reshoot, and I started seeing things online. And I guess, all right, well, I guess people are interested now, you know, in the reshoot. And then once I talked to Heather Buckley, who was doing like the Blu-ray part of The Exorcist 3, it dawned on me that no one knew about this. Like, nobody really knew about this reshoot.
Wow.
So I told my story, and then people kind of reached out to me, and that's kind of, I went, oh, wow, I guess this is information about this. But I kind of forgot about it until recently. And so that's kind of how I fit into it. So every day I would get into the set, first one in the makeup trailer, about 4.5 hours later, the makeup would be on. We would work, and then I'd get back in the makeup trailer and be the last one to leave. So they were very long days. But working with Nicole the entire time in the cell, with the fire, the snakes, and what was the other thing? I don't remember if it was a gimbal set that they used for Nicole with him when he was peeling his face off.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
It was an insanely educational literally trial by fire experience for someone who's never worked on a set like that,
right?
To walk into a situation like that and be a part of like the Exorcist history kind of thing, you know?
And I mean, people, like,
that was a very long-winded answer to your question. So
I please keep going. I mean, this is what people want to know about, you know, people, right. And me included and Zach included, we love that movie.
Yeah.
You know, it's like this little redheaded stepchild that we all love type of thing.
Oh, it's a great film. Yeah.
It really is. I watched it last night with my wife, just kind of trying to acclimate myself. And my wife's like, I've loved this movie. I was like, I know, it's really, really good. And of course I was like trying to point out where you were and whatnot in it. But like, when you like read the lines, they didn't say like to try to do it like Jason Miller?
No.
Or you just sort of, you hit it and they're like, okay, cool.
Right. But, well, I found out later, and I don't know if it was the same day or if it was the day that I showed up on set, but the gentleman that came in the green room was Bill Blatty.
Oh, okay.
I had no idea. I had no idea.
Wow.
And it was probably a good thing I didn't know.
Yeah,
because you always hear names, and this is before the internet, right? So you don't really know what people look like. You've kind of seen them in People magazine, maybe. You know what I mean? That's what we're looking at. So when it rolled around, I kind of went, yeah, that's fine. I was so fortunate to be a part of this, but just to watch, just people like Nicole Williamson, and all I kept thinking was, I'm working with Merlin from Excalibur. Because that's who he was to me, right? So, and he still got that big booming voice that he has, you know. And sometimes I'd be sitting there in the makeup, and the fire flames are going, and the snakes are being dropped on me, and I'm sitting there in the straitjacket, and I'm trying to go through this dialogue that, you know, obviously they're looping Jason in. It's not my voice, but I keep thinking, you know, that's Merlin. You know, every once in a while it'll hit me like, that's Merlin.
Where's your metal cap?
your head. Das Dahl Rock, you know.
Yeah, we reviewed that movie. We love it. My buddy over at our friend over at Return Revenge Resurrection, Alex, he loves this movie, Exorcist 3. And he wanted me to ask you specifically, what was the mood like on set? And because Blatty is open about the fact that he didn't want the exorcism in it, and then, you know, he kind of had to do it sort of reluctantly. Did you have, were you aware of that at all on set, or was it just business as usual?
I can tell you, again, you to put yourself in my shoes, I've only been in LA for a few months, right? I'm now immersed in a reshoot that I'm not convinced how many people really wanted to happen. Okay.
Right.
But that's so removed and lost on me because I'm not really part of those conversations. I'm part of the conversations of what's happening to me now in real time. Right. So the only way I can answer your friend's question is to say the vibe was thick. It was heavy. I can say, speaking as an actor being put in that position, Bill Blatty, to me, was the voice of reason and the voice of calm, who went out of his way to make sure that, you know, my time in the makeup and my time in front of the fire, and you know, he was aware of that. So I felt like I had an ally, whether I did or whether I didn't, I don't know, but I'm telling you how I felt about the situation.
Yeah.
And I don't know, because that's more of a behind the scenes conversation that some guy who just fell off the truck, who's now in makeup on a set, is probably not part of.
You're just trying not to get bit by those cobras or catch on fire.
They were real. They were real. Don't kid yourself. There was glass up there, and they had a snake wrangler in there. That I just remember sitting in that straitjacket, and I'm taking this box of snakes and just dumping it on my head. There must have been 15 snakes in that thing. And what are you going to do? Because you're shackled, you know. But
you're like, guys, isn't this great?
I kept thinking that this too shall pass.
I mean, you're like, I'm working with Merlin here, and that was magic. This is a different kind of magic. This is like black magic going on.
Right now. There was a vibe. The air was pretty thick. That's the best way I can explain it. But I don't necessarily remember any weirdness happening because I think people wanted to get those days. They wanted the pages shot. They wanted to keep moving. And I'll always have those memories of what that experience was, but it doesn't take away from the fact that Jason's always going to be Father Karras. He's always going to be, you know, patient zero in the film. You know, it doesn't take away anything at all from Jason. I was a fan of Jason. So it was, and he was very kind enough the 2 days I was there to understand what my role was going to be moving forward. So he let me sit in and watch what he was doing and try to get a lot of his mannerisms down and how he would move. And I appreciated that.
That has to be like a very unique experience for a young actor just sort of coming into Hollywood. I imagine that's not what you expected, like one of your earlier gigs would sort of be like.
No, not at all. The way it was explained to me was supposed to be some sort of stand-in. But then once I got there and then once I got on set, I'm thinking this is not a stand-in role. I mean, we're shooting it, right? So I think the makeup, the prosthetic makeup guys, you know, Bill and Mike in the trailer, those guys knocked it out of the park, because when I was in makeup, people didn't know it wasn't Jason.
Oh yeah, you can't tell.
No, not at all. In fact, you know, I Bill tells this story, so I know it's okay to tell this story. But every once in a while, you know, Bill or Mike and I would walk around the studio and go have lunch somewhere in the makeup, and people would be staring because, yeah, obviously it's a lot of makeup, but people would think it was Jason Miller, you know, hanging out with him. You know, but no, it was me.
Just good old Charles Edwin Powell.
just me. Just fell off the turnip truck.
I think what's really interesting to me to think about in that respect, that you literally just arrived and you're working on a movie that is, you know, at the time when it came out, I remember when it came out, everyone was freaking out about it. Like Exorcist 3, you're part of this franchise that's huge. Overwhelming, I would assume, you know, as starting your career out doing something like that, like, oh my gosh, here we go, you know, but also like, if you're going to be a part of something when you first get to Hollywood, that's a pretty good thing to be a part of.
The one thing I will always take away from that movie is how a set is run, because I had up in Texas, you know, I'd done a few commercials and I did a lot of theater, a lot of musical theater, and then I did a lot of commercials, but you don't really have a lot of opportunity in Houston to work on projects. Houston wasn't really a hub. I don't know if it is now, but it wasn't really an in-demand city to go shoot in. So you kind of took the experiences for what they were, tried to make the most of it, learn what you can and keep moving.
Right.
The Exorcist 3, boy, it's one of those things that felt like it was 2 months of shooting over those, over those 3.5 weeks.
Wow.
They were insane. I don't know that I ever saw the sun, because I would get in the trailer in the morning. They would have to unlock the trailer to let me in. And then the makeup guys would show up, and then everybody would wrap, and then it would just be me and the makeup guys left in the trailer, and then we'd go home. So we would miss the whole, you know. But again, you sign up for that, right? I mean, it's not complaining. It's just kind of like part of the business. Yeah. But you put yourself in that grind because you want to be a part of that grind. You know what I mean? It's a choice that you make. So I think it's something that's always going to file away back there. And I do kind of look at it and go, how was I in this movie? Like, what was I doing?
But, well, you know, two specific movies, you know, Screamers and now Exorcist 3, both celebrating, you know, kind of benchmark anniversaries, 35th and 30th.
You're making me feel old now. Yeah.
No, but it's a beautiful thing. But here you are with Scream now. Yeah. You know, in 2025, I know the movie came out last year, but still, like, you know, that's the beautiful thing. You were working with some genre veterans in Stream. And I don't know, maybe we're all getting older. We are all getting older, but it's beautiful to see people who have been working hard at a craft for so long continue to be able to given the opportunity because they're so damn good at it. You are such a good actor. Clearly, you know, we're fans of your work, but you're also an awesome dude too outside of that. But like, it's nice to see that. It's refreshing.
Yeah,
because
I don't often do that.
You don't.
I know.
See
it's
that
like as much as I wanted to interview you for so long, I saw you were working and everything, and it's just like, I'm just happy. I'm happy that you're working on a horror franchise and stuff like that, and that's blowing up and everything. Like, you know, Zach's saying, it's, you know, we're not just, you know, fans of yours and stuff, and obviously you love talking to you, a great person, interacting with you online, but I'm happy to see that, you know, you're still rocking and rolling and everything, and Stream is awesome, and, you know, and you got some upcoming projects as well. Do you want to talk about any of those?
Yeah, in fact, Screamboat. Yeah,
can you talk about any of those?
Yes, I can. Yes, I can.
Okay.
Screamboat, which is the Steamboat Willie horror film.
Amazing.
Should be in L. It should be where you are Thursday. No, maybe today. When maybe it's today.
Today's Thursday, yeah.
Maybe it's coming out today. And then I'm going to the New York premiere on Monday here in the city. And then we've got some sort of satellite theaters in and around New York, Pennsylvania, that area that's going to be showing the film as well. But I told Mike, I have such love for the Fuzz Boys that have created the, you know, the Terrifier stuff and with Phil and with Stream and now with Screamboat that, you know, I told Mike even back in the day, I said, I'll play dead guy number 42 for you if you want me to. Just right. Ask me, you know, and right. And that's kind of how Screamboat rolled around too, you know.
Can you talk about your role in that, or do you have to kind of keep that a little bit under wraps?
No, I don't necessarily have a whole lot to do in this. I'm playing the boy's father, the president of the borough who is trying to save his son. And that's really all I can talk about, you know, with regard to Screamboat. But yeah, I'm actually looking. I haven't seen it yet, so I'm looking forward to seeing it as well on Monday.
I think it's amazing because look, I was never a Disney fan as a kid. I was always a Warner Brothers kid. You know, I grew up watching Daffy Duck and Bugs Bunny and really digging that, and then when I heard that this was coming out and people were up in arms, like, oh my God, you're taking this iconic character and blah, 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 blah. I'm like, iconic to who? Like, I get it. Get it. But, you know, I'm like, why not? Just do it. Right. Have fun with it. You know, we grew up on Garbage Pail Kids.
Yeah.
Right? And Garbage Pail Kids.
They made fun of everything. And
made fun
everyone.
Of everything. You know? And I think in this day and age, people often say, you know, it's like, I think people are trying to figure out how can you make fun of everything and still have it be okay. And that, I think Garbage Pail Kids are a perfect example of that, where everyone's like, it's just silly. Come on, have fun. This movie looks wild.
Yeah, no,
and
it's so, not.
It is. Looks, I cannot wait to watch it.
You and me both. I've only seen the trailers. So you and I are literally on the same level at this point with, cause I have no idea what to expect. I really don't, but I'm looking forward to it. I had a good time shooting it. Yeah. We shot it in Staten Island. And we shot it on the ferry that, those two guys from Saturday Night Live own it. Colin Jost and who's the other kid that owns it?
Michael Che or?
No. The guy with all the tattoos. I can't remember his name.
My brain too.
Yeah.
Pete Davidson.
Pete Davidson. Thank right, you. That's thank right. you.
Someone's listening.
Someone's
to this
driving
going,
off the road right now.
Pete, I'm sorry. Just a mental block, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But they were kind enough to gracious enough to let us shoot on the boat, and it looked from where I was, it looks fantastic.
That's great.
And you're based out of that area now. What brought you up there to the East Coast?
My wife. Yeah. Okay. She's from Long Island.
Oh, cool.
And we had a long conversation about moving to LA, and she's established here with her company and work and stuff. So we just decided to make the East Coast our home.
Nice.
Well, I can't wait to get back into LA and work too. I mean, I keep hammering my manager and my agents. I said, let's go that way for a little while. You know,
when you mentioned doing the convention circuit, which, you know, is again, Corey and I grew up, like, I was going to Fangoria conventions back in the early 90s, and that was a time when you'd, you know, go down to the hotel in the morning and you'd be hanging out with Tim Thomerson or something like that, or Adrian Barbeau or whatever. And it was very casual. And now it's fandom has taken a whole new, you know, it looks totally different now.
For but better also, or worse. You
for
know.
Better or worse. And but better in your case, because I think it's opening up opportunities for people who are like, look, I'm not shooting anything right now. There's a convention coming up. I want to get out here and get some, you know, people can meet me and I get to meet them. And it's great. I love that. So when you're saying you're doing the scene now, the convention scene, I thought, well, there's a lot of conventions going on out here as well. It would be great to see you out here doing one. And I'm a part of a few, so we can talk offline about that.
It's an easy hop, skip, and a jump from Oregon down to L.A. So
oh yeah, sure. We'll get you down here for
definitely
for sure.
Come down.
I you wouldn't have to twist my arm, not at all.
I did want to ask you about a short film called Found that you worked on. How was that? What was that experience like?
That experience was very personal for me. This is going to sound strange, and I have no way to explain this other than to just say it out loud. For years, and maybe other actors have this thing in their head too, I've had the character of Max in the movie Found in my head for 15, 20 years. I can't explain it, but when I read the breakdown, I submitted myself on this thing, and I said, I want to be a part of this. So I did the audition. The guy called me back. It all worked out. The way I'm happy it worked out that way. But my father was a Marine. He passed away a few years ago, and he was very much into the awareness of what homeless veterans go through, the resources that they have, the resources that are lacking, and trying to get help to these people. And when I did Found, Max's character is a homeless veteran who has been living on the streets for a while. He's off his meds, and he deals with schizophrenia and PTSD. It's kind of a heavy character, but it was a character that felt so familiar to me because I've had him in my head for so long. And once I wrapped, I realized that this weight, this cathartic weight had come off my shoulders. And I can't explain it. I just wish my dad was around to see it because I think he'd have been all over it. You know, but we won at the Fort Lauderdale International Film Festival a couple of months ago. We won the Best Of. We just got accepted into another film festival, the Europa Film Festival, and I think it's in Spain or Barcelona, maybe it's Barcelona. And then so I'm hoping that the little film that could just keeps on chugging along because it is a very special story. It means a great deal to me. And I hope that the producers and directors can take it to where they want to go, because I think ultimately they want to turn it into a feature. And I think that storyline has so much depth and such a groundedness of it that I really hope it works out for them. I really do.
Yeah, it looks like a beautiful film. I've seen you post, you know, some videos of it and pictures and everything, and I want to see it. I don't know where we can. I don't think we can right now.
I don't think
now.
You can't. Yeah, I think Steve's got it working the festival circuit with Jules right now. So okay. I think they're gonna really kind of push that situation right now. I'm sure as soon as I see it accessible somewhere, I will let people know. I'll let you guys know.
Okay, I definitely want to watch that, and hopefully if it goes to, you know, a full feature, then, you know, maybe the Blu-ray will also include the short, you know, or something on it. But it does look like a beautiful film.
Oh, it is. It's a beautiful story. It's a sad. It's a tragic story.
Yeah.
But with that comes awareness, and that's really what Steve and Jules were behind, is pushing the awareness of getting the veterans the help that they need, and having access to it. You know, even if they're on the streets.
Yeah.
It's really deep to go there, to have this character in you for such a long period of time, and for it be able to come full circle and do it. That's powerful. I mean, that gave me chills just thinking about it, because we don't often get the opportunity to, you know, I don't want to, lack of a better word, confront these characters or these things in our lives, these walls, or whether it's a wall or something, but to break through and become one with it, that's really special. I mean, we're getting a little deep here, and that's what we do on our show sometimes, but it's true. Like, you know, there's a psychological aspect to that where you can rest with this character now.
Yeah. No, I feel like I've passed Max on to them, and whatever, yeah. whatever happens to Max is now, you know, he's out of my head. And now it's up to Jules and Steve to see where he heads.
You know? Well, you had your possession, you know, and you were able to exercise you, those demons.
That's so. A great word, you know, to tie it all back together.
To tie it all back together.
I was going to tell you, I'm a huge wrestling fan, and I do a wrestling show as well. And you being in Texas, it's a hotbed for wrestling.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. Terry Funk, who is a wrestling icon, also from Texas, you know, had said he was scared as he got older because he thought people would forget about him, you know, and he did an interview once where he basically had said, I think people are going to forget about me down the road. And the interviewer was like, no one's going to forget about you, Terry. Like, you know, clearly with the advent of social media and YouTube and whatnot, people can access your stuff. But the same goes true for someone like you. And I'm not comparing you to Terry Funk, but what I am saying is you've got this body of work that dates back. Okay, we're not dating you at all, but we are saying you've got a resume of work that stands the test of time, and you can look on that and say, I'm working on a project now. It's so awesome. If you go, guys, go to Charles Edwin Powell's IMDb page and like give it a like or whatever, like boost up his do that for everybody that you're a big fan of. It's so awesome to see like all these credits of things you're working on right now and to go date back all the way to like, you know, 1987.
Yeah. And, you know, like, obviously we're a genre podcast. We love our horror and our sci-fi and stuff. But I mean, you have an extensive dramatic, you know, background and everything in your movies. Like, you were in Affliction and whatnot. There's a lot of amazing movies to talk about. We only have an hour, you know, to talk. But like, I mean, my goodness, like some amazing, amazing films. So if you're not familiar with Charles Edwin Powell's body of work, please, like Zach said, go to IMDb, check it out. Give him, you know, give his Instagram page a like, follow him on Facebook and everything like that. It's again, an extensive body of work there.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. I really do.
And so when you say like you're working with, you know, all these big titans of horror, it's like, well, no, but you're now a part of that.
Yeah, you are a titan of horror.
We will see where this journey heads, gentlemen. We will see.
Well, I hope that it's more about surviving, because I think that's one thing that kind of, you know, grinds my gears at times, where I see these characters I really dig on screen and I'm like, I don't want to see this guy get killed. And sometimes they do. Sometimes they don't.
Sometimes they do.
And when they do, it's
unfortunately
very, very deflating. You're like, no.
I was really kind of hoping in Screamers that I was going to be one of those robot guys when I was reading.
I hope so too.
I was really kind of hoping that was the direction it was going, you know?
Well, I can imagine that the Exorcist 3 stuff is probably your most extensive makeup and effects and everything. Now, you did get a knife sunk into your chest in Screamers. Like, what was that? Was that just a prosthetic they just kind of like put right there and nothing major to it?
Yeah, it wasn't real high tech. It was from what I remember, it's a swish. With Roy throwing the knife, and it was a swish, and the knife is already sticking in there. But it's, you know, I just wanted one more last gasp of get off my back, man. You know, and I got to say, with that line, that was probably the hardest line for me to say in the whole movie, because when you read something like that, you kind of go, oh, boy, what am I going to do with this? Because there's so many directions you can go. Right.
Yeah.
Right. And I remember sitting at home watching a clip or something. It was something that had to do with aliens, and it was Bill Paxton. And when I heard Bill Paxton and aliens, I went, that's it. That's what it is right there. That's what, game over, man. Get off my back.
That's good company to be a part of.
And he's a fellow Texas guy too.
Yep. He sure is.
No, it's just, that was one of those lines where I really had no idea where this was going to go until I heard that. And I went, you know what? We're going to do a little homage and see if I can get
it. Yeah.
And hey, now everybody knows it. I mean, all the fans, I'm sure everyone comes up to you and say, get off my back and everything. You're like, at some point you're going to be tired of hearing it.
Nah, not at all. I'll get tired if they don't keep coming up. Maybe that's
there you go. There you go.
I remember seeing Hootie and the Blowfish one year, and they're like, at the end of the night, they're like, okay, we got one more song for you. And they're like, hold my hand. And Darius Rucker goes, yeah, I know you guys like that song, but we're never playing that song again. The crowd starts booing. He's like, just kidding. And they go into it and everyone goes nuts. So there's always going to be love for a famous line or a song.
Yeah, you always kind of have a little fan service and everything, you know.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure someone now is like, you talk about Hootie and the Blowfish? I love Hootie and the Blowfish.
I love Darius Rucker. I like Darius Rucker too, man. I think he's got a great sound. Yeah,
sure does. So working with Peter Weller, he's a trip. He seems like a trip. I've watched the Robo Doc that he did, the documentary about RoboCop. and I think he's a professor now. He has a degree and
I think so, yeah.
You know, so you said it was a good experience working with him, but did he kind of impart his knowledge as an actor down to you?
Not necessarily, because a lot of my scenes, even though I was part of that group, I didn't have a whole lot of sort of one-on-one with Peter, even though we were all in the bunker together.
Yeah,
a lot of the downtime that we had in between setups was just trying to stay warm. So people would run off and just try to stay warm, you know, because we weren't anywhere close to a heater and there were no palm heater thingies.
Yeah,
you know, so you're looking for one of those big sort of floor heaters that are blowing at football games.
Yeah,
you know, those things that are blowing.
Yeah,
that's what we had. So we were all kind of lined up near that thing, saying, all right, are you ready to go? Okay, let's go. And then we run back out in the snow. You know?
Director says cut and everyone scatters.
That's exactly what happened.
It's gotta be hard to act in moments like that, because it distracts you from what's going on in the script or in the, you know, when you're shooting, just being so cold.
Yeah, but I think it works. You know,
because sure.
I think if you're out there and you look at the mats or the screen, there's snow everywhere. There's snow up to the. So if you're trying to act like you're on a beach somewhere, it's not going to work.
Yeah, it's not going
to
track. Yeah.
So it does help on a subconscious level to you know, for your knees to be shaking constantly because you're freezing, you know, or your toes going numb. And it just kind of helps you fidget a little bit more, trying to twitch when you don't really necessarily want to. It just kind of happens, you know.
You reminded me of a scene from the TV show Who's the Boss, where the power went out and they were like stuck there for a day or something, and Angela's freezing and Tony's like, "Hey, Angela, just close your eyes and think of something warm and think of being on a beach." And he does that and he sees Angela in a bikini and you're like, "Oh, what's going on there?" So.
That story.
No, I can't say there weren't any bikinis. But
I don't know. It just popped in my head. This is what happens to me. So, but no, Charles, are you a wrestling fan by chance?
I was growing up. I go back to like the Wahoo McDaniel days, and this is probably way before your time. And
I know Wahoo McDaniel.
Oh, you do? Yeah.
That's kind of where the Woos came from that Ric Flair adopted. Yeah. So.
But that was something that we all watched on Sundays. That was back when wrestling was real.
Right. But living in Texas, so it's Von Erich country. Yep. Well, Dallas is Von Erich country. Did you ever check out the Von Erichs?
No, I do remember like watching them growing up, but no, I haven't seen the film, which I was pretty good.
Yeah. I highly recommend people watching The Iron Claw, because it's a hard movie to watch, but it's damn amazing. Kind of like, you know, to go along with Found, you know, Found, like you said, is very personal and but it's also very hard to watch, but these are important films. I mean, they need to be seen.
Yeah. And I believe that, in the power of film and, you know, expressing ideas and feelings and emotions. So I'm very much looking forward to watching Found, and I'm very much looking forward to watching Screamboat and rewatching Stream. And of course, rewatching Screamers for the 500th time, because I
off
love
my
that freaking movie.
Yeah.
Charles, thank you so much for coming on the show, man. This has been, I mean, I love talking to you. I've been wanting to talk to you for years now.
Likewise,
this has been everything that I've ever wanted it to be. So thank you so much.
Oh, it's completely my pleasure. Thank you for having me, man. I absolutely love this. And anybody that's still a fan of Screamers is a friend of mine.
Thank you for listening to Podcasting After Dark's exclusive interview series with Charles Edwin Powell. And, as always, thank you for your support.